Welcome to Practice Care with Carl White, the podcast where we help practice owners in healthcare know just enough about the business side to make good business decisions and keep their practices independent. Now our host, Carl.
All right, so let me set this up. So you've got a practice, but you've got a new business as well that you want to start. Maybe it's something you've invented, like a new device or a product, or it's an offshoot of your current practice, or maybe it's something else. In any of those cases, you probably need some funding. My guest today is an expert in equity funding, and she's going to give us an introduction to it. I'm Carl White, principal at Mark Advisory Group, which is a healthcare marketing agency, and I'm also the host of Practice Care. The mission for both is the same, and that's to help private practice owners stay private. Not only is that what they want, but let's face it, when your provider has complete clinical freedom to make the decisions for you and with you that you think are best, then that's as good as it can get. And that most commonly happens when the provider owns the place as opposed to being employed by someone else. And my guest today is Leslie Cohen. Leslie is the founder and managing partner of All Rise Legal Counsel. She concentrates her transactional practice in securities and startup law, corporate finance, technology law, mergers and acquisitions, and general corporate law. She represents clients across many industries, from consumer products to tech companies to healthcare businesses to real estate firms. She started her practice at a Wall Street firm in 1992, spent 13 years there honing her skills at a large firm based in Chicago, and left to form All Rise in 2010. All Rise was founded on Leslie's desire to work with earlier stage and smaller businesses, and each of its attorneys is big firm trained and experienced. All Rise counsel startups and growth stage companies in connection with their entity formation, founder and advisor equity grants, and early fundraising rounds, whether friends and family investments, angel seed, or venture capital rounds. All Rise also represents real estate funds in the syndication process. Leslie herself graduated from NYU School of Law in 1992 and from the big, blue, beautiful University of Michigan, Go Blue, in 1989. Leslie is busy on top of everything else. She is a member of the board of directors of the Small Business Advisory Council, a co-founder of the Coalition of Women's Initiatives in Law, and a frequent speaker and mentor for accelerator and incubator programs, including the Hatchery, Good Food Accelerator, the Wisconsin Technology Council, Workbox, and the University of Michigan's Opportunity Hub, and is a member of the All Raise community, a speaker at the annual GirlCon conference for high school girls in STEM, and a judge for the annual Founders First Chicago Job Creators Grant. Leslie, I don't know how the hell you found time to come on here with everything you've got going on top of everything else that's going on. Thank you for taking some time to come on Practice Care and demystifying this useful and important topic.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So how'd you get into startup funding? I always start with guests. Tell us a bit more about yourself and want to hear more about that. But as you tell us more about you, tell us how you got into the world of startup funding as well.
Sure. So I had been in big law for many, many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I was doing the work and other people were generating that work. Other people had the clients. And then when I went on my own, I had to build my own book of business. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of looking for a niche in the market where I could do something a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And I, as a trained securities lawyer, so securities lawyer just means helping companies that raise money.
Okay.
And so I had been doing that with, you know, $500 million deals for mm-hmm. my whole 20-year career. Mm-hmm. And the laws governing that are the exact same as the laws governing raising $100,000. Just, you know, obviously very different market, different terms, all of that.
Right.
And so I saw this, I started networking and I saw this kind of place in the market. The lawyers who knew what they were doing in securities law were all these huge firms charging a fortune. Mm. And so I learned that startup market and I started marketing myself and our firm in that way. And that's how I got into it.
And so there was a gap in the market. The laws are the same, which means it's as complicated as hell, no matter how much you're trying to raise. And so those who are trying to raise a fraction still have to go through the same complications. Okay. That makes sense. And so we're talking today specifically about equity investments, and let's get into it. Just for those who don't know, and I think I know, but I'll bet you I'm wrong, what is an equity investment and what's the process at a high level of going after one?
So an equity investment is when you sell some kind of an ownership stake in your business to a third.
Okay.
And so that's overall versus a debt investment where you have someone loans you money that you have to repay. This is someone actually has an ownership part of your business.
Okay.
So that's
okay. So that's what it is. And what's the, you know, compared to going to a bank and getting a loan, which super simplifies it, what does it look like to go out there and sell a piece of your business to go get equity investments?
Yeah, it's definitely more difficult. Depending on who you're looking for as your investor. So if you have friends and family that are willing to give you the money, it's not all that difficult. It's not all that challenging. It's more, having your legal ducks in a row, which we, you know, I think we'll get into later. Mm-hmm. If you don't have people who are willing to write you a check, then it's going out there and finding those investors. And so that requires that you have a pitch deck, which is, you know, just a summary, basically like an executive summary of your company. Mm-hmm. It definitely requires that you know how to talk about your company in a way that makes it enticing for investors. And then you have to actually identify those investors. The first stage investors are usually called angel investors. And there are angel investors that you can find by just, you know, Googling. And they're networks of people who get together. And like I'm part of a couple of them. They get together and everybody can put in whatever dollars they want for one particular investment. And then, you know, then the group will send out like, here's another possibility. Here's another possibility. And then everyone can decide whether they want to invest. So that's one route. There are also angel funds. Like here in Chicago, there's Hyde Park Angels. There's, there are a bunch of them where people actually put money into a fund, and then the people who head up the fund decide, you know, which investments to put the money into.
Okay.
And then there's just like one-off through people, you know, like I have a whole network of just high net worth individuals who are interested in certain spaces. Maybe they're retired. And I actually have someone in healthcare who's retired, and he said, you know, send me any interesting deals where people are looking for money in the healthcare space.
And then from the legal side, you know, because that's the other big part of it. So first you find, all right, somebody's willing to give me money in exchange for X percent, but that's not the end of it. That's the beginning, right? So from the legal point of view, what high level, what's it look like?
So high level, what it looks like is you do what's called a subscription agreement.
Okay.
Well, let me take a real quick step back. High level, what's required by law, the federal and state securities laws, is that you tell anyone who's thinking about investing in your company whatever a reasonable person would want to know in making that same decision. So the goal of the legal work that's done, to just very high level, the goal is to tell all your investors, hey, there's a huge competitor out there in the market. We think we're better, but you should know that. Or, you know, we're very, very early stage. This is just an idea. Or, you know, anything, so that if someone loses their investment, they can't come back to you and say, hey, you were supposed to tell me this. As a reasonable person, you should have told me this and you didn't, and therefore I have a fraud lawsuit against you. So that's the overall goal of the legal documentation.
To not get sued later.
Exactly. So
that's a lot of a goal.
And I get a lot of pushback because the documentation basically like says all these risks, right? Yeah. And I get, you know, people say, well, how am I supposed to raise money giving them this document? And I say, this is not your sales document. That's your pitch deck. This is your insurance policy.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that they can't come back later. You didn't tell me that yet. Now, does that have to, I'm curious, do you have to update that? Because it can take a while to, you know, if some new competitor comes out or some new risk is identified, do you have to update that?
That's like, actually a great
question.
What's
the burden to like keep it current, I guess, right?
It's a great question. There's no duty to update under the federal and state securities laws if someone's already decided to invest. So once you're in, you have the latest information at the moment you're making that decision, you're fine. But like, let's say you give me $100,000, I'm looking for $500,000. A new competitor comes on the market and I'm still looking for the other 400. I have to tell those other potential investors.
And is that because the moment you give 100, you're kind of in and you need to be doing that on your own? Like, it's kind of on you to stay current, or it's just.
It's really, even if you stay current, you can't, you don't have rights to take back the money. So like, you've made it's a binding contract at that point.
Okay. And what's the burden for like completeness on the person going after, like, who needs, I'm trying to raise money from you. So I'm putting out all this list of risks. I obviously need to do the best I can, but if I miss some corner of the world with a risk, is that too bad for me? Is that going to bite me later?
No, it's that reasonable standard. What a reasonable person. I mean, you know, if it's something somewhat predictable.
Okay. I gotcha. So how does this type of investment compare to other types of funding? Like, when is it a good fit? My simple world, I go to a bank and get a loan. That's you know, the sort of, you know, the universe that I'm aware of. So how does it compare? Like, when...
Yeah. So to get a loan, you have to have assets to secure the loan.
Okay.
And that's why early stage companies usually end up going this equity fundraising route, because they don't have the assets to back up a loan.
Okay.
So that's the big difference. And then I guess, you know, another reason why you'd want to do this, even if you do have those assets, is what we in the industry call smart money. So let's say someone's willing to write you a check, they want a piece of your business, and they're really like going to be helpful in terms of advising or opening doors,
right,
or whatever it is for your business. And they say, if I'm going to do this for you, I want to have a little piece of the action, not just get paid back the money that I lend you.
Mm-hmm. So that gets into the terms of the investment.
Right.
Gotcha. Which I'm sure is a whole thing.
Other reason I'll throw in there is that that early stage companies often don't have a valuation. Like, how do you value something that's all based on the future? And so equity fundraising has, there's two different instruments that are used that allow you to skip that valuation. And they're basically you give me $100,000 as the business owner, I promise to, I give you a piece of paper back. It's called a SAFE, a simple agreement for future equity, that says when I am able to put a valuation on the company and raise my next round of capital, or when I sell the business, that piece of paper converts into $100,000 worth of investment along with that next round, but you get a discount because you took a chance early on me. And so let's say, as an example, the next round investors come in at $10 a share. Mm-hmm. You get to buy $100,000 worth at $8 a share because you took that early chance.
Okay. So that, as you were saying, I'm like, so how do you possibly, if you're the $100,000 investor, what do you base it on? Like, it's just, I guess it's a lot of due diligence on your side too then, right? It would have to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it would definitely have to be. Okay. Think about equity, and we're talking about equity investing, obviously. What does it need to succeed? So there's both sides. We've been talking about both sides, right? So if I needed 500,000 and, you know, you were at the table for 100 and we are thinking about doing this together, in order for this to, not just for you to give me the check for the 100, but for it to work, like, you know, what does it need to succeed? Because you want it to work, right? You don't want it to go south. So what kinds of, and think about that, my question, as broadly as you can, like, you know, it's more than a financial transaction, I guess, right?
So you mean, what does it take to make the startup successful?
Not necessarily the startup, but just, you know, now you and I are having a relationship, whereas before we were strangers because you just invested $100,000, you know, into my idea. And so I want it to work. You want it to work. Aside from me doing everything I can to make the business work, like, what have you seen that, you know, makes it successful?
So there's opening your network as an investor, you know, opening your network to the founder of the startup, providing advisory services. is always really helpful from your investor. I work with a couple of serial angel investors, and that's why they do it, because they, I mean, they have enough money, they're retired, but they just love to be on an advisory board because they've built so many businesses. And so that's something that's really, really helpful. You know, and making any introductions possible. I mean, I guess also, I mean, this goes both ways, but I was going to say, I was going to say, you know, being open to being understanding about the fact that the founders are doing everything they can to make this business successful, and trying to be a little patient.
Okay.
And I think, you know, I mean, I usually represent the founders. So, you know, I know there's struggles, and I think there's this hype. I mean, it's died down recently, but obviously there's this hype around, you know, oh, when are you going public? When are you, you know, I'm in early stage investing. I'm going to make, you know, be the next Facebook. And it just isn't like that. It's like any one of us building our businesses. It's like, you know, your listeners building their practices. It takes time. It takes effort. It's not, most people are not Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, it just doesn't, you know, so having that understanding toward your founders, that they're doing their best.
Right. And what about from the founder's point of view? Like what should they, you know, take that question and go in the opposite direction from the founder. So now, you know, investors be patient, investors understand. What about from the founder point of view?
Communication, a million percent communication. It heads off all these, you know, if you don't hear from the founder and you've given them a lot of money, and, you know, you start to get like, what is going on? And you start to imagine the worst. And especially if all of a sudden you get like a quarterly report and the numbers are terrible, or, you know, the progress they were supposed to have made. I mean, I think honesty, asking for help when you need it, and just communicating.
Okay. That makes sense. What are some of the more common reasons you see these types of investments fail? I mean, aside from the business not working, because that's, you know, that's what we can all wrap our head around, but you see this all the time. So like, or you do this all the time. So what do you see?
So, you know, one of the things, you know, the topic of this discussion is a side hustle, right? So that's always a question, is like, if it's a side hustle, how much are you in? And, and how do you attract investors when it's a side thing for you? I think that's going to be an immediate red flag for potential investors, is like, well, how much time are you actually giving this? So I would say sooner rather than later, finding a co-founder who maybe, you know, complements your skill set. I think I've seen a lot of different, I do a lot of pitch competition judging and running, and I've seen a lot of investors, like, I would say 50% say, I want you to have a co-founder, I want you to have a team. So all the different boxes are checked in terms of skill sets. And then others say, which is the other side of this, and one of the things I'll tell you why a lot of these fail, is that co-founder relationship can be really, really difficult. You know, there's definitely two sides to that discussion. But I think if it's a side hustle, then it's even more important that you have that co-founder in place.
Yeah.
So I see that as a big reason for these, you know, not to succeed.
Because a business, especially when you're growing it needs full-time attention, I would think. So it's sort of the need behind the ask of, I want you to have a co-founder because I want somebody there full-time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And the team and everything else. Yeah. Okay. What else do you see that, you know, that just these, you know, top five reasons why these investments don't end up not working out?
I would say not having done the market research to find who your customer is. Wow. And you know, really understanding if, like, just because you think something's a great idea doesn't mean that there's a market out there for it.
Yeah.
And sort of related to that, when someone comes to me and says, you know, this is my idea and I can implement this idea in these 40 different markets. And therefore my potential market size is like, you know, $12 billion, like calm down, pick one.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, like your practice is centered on, you know, focused on medical, dental, mine is focused on startups. I can do a lot of different kinds of legal work, but I think, you know, having that niche is really important because you become really, really, really good at what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so when clients come to me and that's what the first thing they say, like, I'm going to take over the world because, you know, I can go here and here and here and here with my business. Like, just tell me where you're going to start.
Yeah.
Like, let's focus and succeed there. And then we can go to tackle the next market.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another really big reason.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is, and I don't know if this is a failure, but it's a huge cost. Mm-hmm. A lot of people just are so excited about their business and that people have been helpful to them. And they're like, you know, oh, you've been so great, I'll give you 1% of the company. And, you know, or you know, 2%, yeah, whatever it is. And there's no documentation. And then you're really in trouble because, yeah, then like, let's say you go your separate ways and people, you know, the businesses come to me and they say, well, that person doesn't really have any equity. We never signed anything. Did you email it to them? Because if you succeed, they're coming back and looking for it.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. And they probably did. They probably did. Cause they always do. So when should somebody who's thinking about this bring you in? I mean, it's funny. I talked to a lot of service providers and the answer is typically a lot earlier than they typically do. So same question to you. When should you bring on legal counsel if you're thinking about this?
Yeah, that's the exact answer. Mm-hmm. Because it starts with what kind of entity should you form? So, you know, there's right. LLCs, there's C corps, there's S corps, and the answer is different. So with most businesses, I would say just like our business, you know, be an LLC, and there's a ton of reasons why, right? It's very flexible, pass through taxation, like all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Venture capital firms, which are your next stage after your very first stage investment, they only invest in Delaware C corporations.
Beats.
So I would ask you when you first come to me and you say, this is my idea and I want to go through the equity funding process. Well, is your ultimate goal to raise venture capital funding? Like, are you looking for investors early on so you can start this business and run it for good, or start this business and sell it real quickly? Mm-hmm. That's different than I want to do, you know, an angel investing round, and then I want to do a Series A preferred round. And then I want, you know, that process, I would say you should be a Delaware C Corp sooner rather than later. So, okay, you know, and forming a Delaware C Corp, there's all these mysteries as to how many shares you authorize, how many shares you issue. And as crazy as that sounds, all of that goes into calculating your franchise taxes every year. So when people do it themselves, I have clients who come to me and are like, oh my God, I got an $80,000 tax bill from the state of Delaware. What do I do? I'm like, I'll fix it. But mm-hmm. For me to fix it means we have to cancel all the stock you issued, redo everything. It's a fortune and it's time consuming and it's a mess. And usually it happens when someone says, oh, I've got someone ready to invest in my company. So like, then it's a rush because then someone's like,
yeah,
wants to write you a check. So sooner rather than later.
Okay. Do you find, I mean, as your answer that, do people commonly come to you and say, you know, I want to do this type of fundraising, that type of fundraising? I just picture myself going, you know, and then you ask, do you imagine yourself, you know, raising money from, I just picture myself saying, you know, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I just know I've got this idea and I, you know, I can't get a loan from a bank because it's so early. But do people commonly come to you with very specific, you know, how they think about where they want to get their money from?
Yes and no. You're right. A lot of them do say, like, I just don't know yet.
Yeah.
You know, typically with like technology, that's where they want to go. They know they want to go that venture capital fundraising route because that's where there are those venture capitalists that want to invest. So, you know, it's a much easier play than kind of business. But yeah, people in other businesses have come to me and said, you know, I just don't know if that's something I'm eventually going to want to do. In which case you can form an LLC and you can convert when you decide you want to do that. It just, the conversion can sometimes be a taxable event. So, yeah.
So do it before you have any profit, I guess.
Exactly.
That sweet spot. I have no profit, but man, I know it's coming. And so I better do it now.
Right.
Gotcha. Awesome. Leslie, this is great. It's kind of taking this topic and bringing it down to earth. Maybe I'm the only one, I can't be, but I feel like I understand it better. A couple of wrap-up questions for you. First one is, in the context of this, is there anything you think I should have asked you but just didn't think to ask you?
No, I think, you know, one of the things that I usually mention that I don't think I got to say that's really important is, if you do have a co-founder in your business, to have a written agreement with them from day one, because you want to have a written agreement with them because something could happen, you know, to either one of you, and then your partner's with someone's child or spouse or whatever it is. And also to make sure to have a written agreement assigning ownership of the intellectual property, which is basically the idea that you have, to the company itself, instead of keeping it in any one person's hands. That's really, really important.
Right.
Those are just a couple of final thoughts.
Yeah. And actually it sparks a kind of a follow-up question. So is it specifically co-founder, or do people come and say, look, you're part-time, you need to have some kind of executive team? There needs to be, I mean, you said team earlier, but because co-founder, I think, all right, if you know, you were my co-founder, then you're a founder, you get some of the equity too, right?
Right.
Don't you? Do you buy that equity, or are you granted that equity typically?
You are usually granted that equity.
Okay.
And the way that,
job.
Yeah. And the way that that equity works is it typically vests over time. That's another thing we actually didn't talk about. That's very important to think about.
Okay.
Is like, if you're a doctor and you've started this side business and you've brought on someone, you know, whether they're a co-founder, whether they're, you know, a COO kind of role, and they want some ownership stake in the business, you want to make sure that, so you grant them, let's say you're granting them 100 shares of stock. They own those 100 shares, but they vest over time, which means that, so typically it's 25% vest after the first year, and then monthly over the next 36 months. And what that means is, if it's not working out between you guys and you terminate that COO before the first year, he or she loses all their equity. They never had any. And then if it's a year and a half goes by, 25% of that becomes theirs. And then you terminate them, or they leave, or whatever, they lose whatever's not vested.
Got it. Yeah, so it climbs over time.
Yeah, it incentivizes them to stick around, and it also makes sure that if within the first year you realize things are not great between you, get out of the relationship before they walk away with some ownership stake.
Got it. Okay, cool. And then the other wrap-up question I ask is, all right, so we've caught somebody's attention, they've been thinking about this, and they're, you know, now they either realize this is an option and learn more about it, and they want to get started. Where, you know, what are the one or two things you'd recommend that they do first to start going down the path of figuring out equity investment for them?
Talk to a lawyer.
Right.
that knows startups.
I almost said it. I wanted you to say it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would say, read, you know, go online and Google like startup investing, and kind of read all, you know, a little more in depth about the process. Or, you know, I've done recordings for several different organizations on early stage fundraising and formation in much more depth. So, you know, I think a lot of different organizations have those recordings available. So
educate yourself, get a lawyer and educate yourself. Makes sense. Definitely makes sense. Cool. Well, Leslie, thank you once again for coming on Practice Care and bringing some clarity to this topic. I really, really appreciate it. Once again, Leslie Cohen is with All Rise Legal Counsel, and we'll put the contact information that you supply me into the show notes for your episode so that anybody who wants to get a hold of you and ask more questions or decide to bring you on, they can do it. So thanks again for coming on. Really very much appreciate it.
It was great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And a couple points before we wrap up. First, if you're someone like Leslie or me that serves private practice owners and you've got some experience that you want to share, or if you are a private practice owner and you've got some experience you think your peers would benefit from, in either case, we want you to come on Practice Care as soon as you can and tell the world about it. In the show notes for Leslie's episode and every episode, there's a link, a couple of questions. Tell us what you're thinking about so that we can get you scheduled as soon as possible. And finally, please subscribe to Practice Care on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're on all the major platforms so that you can get up to date and stay up to date on new episodes. Thanks very much, and until next time.
Thank you for listening to Practice Care with Carl White. Make sure to subscribe and follow so you don't miss another episode. You can find our guest contact information in the show notes. Stay tuned for the next episode.